somebody who spends money to spend clean cut and an alcoholic. Hi. It's good to be here, and I'm happy to know that I'm an alcoholic. You know that I'm impressed. I'm impressed with you, and I'm impressed with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a lot of people in this room that mean a great deal to me. I have known these people a long, long time, and then I have met a lot of people just tonight. That this forever widens my AA community, and for that I'm grateful. I certainly didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous because I wanted to. And I can let the newcomers know that Alcoholics Anonymous is 53 years old, the 10th of June, and we have yet to have our first volunteer. Nobody has ever just gotten here and snapped their fingers and looked excited and said, boy, boy, the world is right, we need it, I'm going to go down and join her aid. I think that if the VA thread that runs through the lives of each and every one of us is the fact that we can all look, and this is for the people that are new and still just shopping, that the people they see in here are not really always, have never been as sanctimonious looking as they are tonight. That people get here for one reason and one reason only, and I should never forget it, I hope you don't, that we get here because the heat's on. And this will put every one of us in the starting blocks in the morning right at the same time. So that I can never look at a person that I meet in Alcoholics Anonymous and wonder if their intentions are honorable. Have you ever seen an honorable drunk? So that I know that whatever motive has brought a person into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you do know, everyone in this room that has been here a little longer than you know that you're just sick and shitless to be here. I want you to know that every one of us knows exactly how you feel. And we thought the same feeling that this thing won't work for me. But it will. There are no failures in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are no failures so far as people that have a dedication and an appreciation, if you will, for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm impressed with this meeting more, I believe, than any meeting that I've ever been to. I want to thank Clancy for asking me to come down here. I wondered how long it was going to take. I followed him around. Well, I followed that man around the world. Just to get him to ask me to come to. I like the structure of this group. I like the structure of an AA meeting where people are common and friendly, and people at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting make people feel welcome. Because you see, that's all that we have. That's all really that we have to offer. The people that are here in the presence of Alcoholics Anonymous is to come here and to establish a hope. Because most of us, before we got here, hope had gone. We knew nothing about hope. So I'm delighted to be here. When I have somebody that comes to town, I want to hurry and bring them here. Now I'm visiting here from Portland, Oregon, and I insisted that he come up with me tonight. And Norm is a guy that is an attraction to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because he's doing what most of you do here tonight. I had the pleasure of speaking up in Portland 5 or 6 years ago, and I had met this gentleman on Friday night, and then on Saturday night, and on Sunday I went to a meeting that he had at the hospital, and left the hospital meeting, and the host drove me out to the airport and dropped me off, and I was very grateful that he had done that. I went in to check at Alaska Airlines to return to landing, and I looked up and I saw this big hawk. I said, "Man, Baker, what are you doing here? What are you doing?" And he said, "I thought that you would have 35 or 40 minutes here, and that you might enjoy some company." So kindness, I think that this is probably the greatest attribute that any of us can bring. We hear a great deal in the program Black Heart Synonymous about people having love for one another. And if you're new, and if you're anything like I was, you didn't know anything about love. You knew a lot about sex, if that's good. You knew a lot about people and that sort of thing, but you knew nothing about love. So then I found out that everybody in our Heart Synonymous has a full and detailed understanding of what kindness is. And that if I have found that in my own life, and the people that practice this, that are kind, that if we practice kindness with everyone that comes into our space, everyone that we come in contact with, then I will guarantee you that working the programs of our hearts and minds is a dead, dead stitch. It's the easiest thing in the world. As a matter of fact, I believe that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is probably the simplest way to live for anyone, and especially we people in Alcoholics Anonymous. So that with all of that, I don't really know what we said and where we're going to go, but I'm sure we'll get out of here on time tonight. I'm going to get to Alcoholics Anonymous. You didn't know it. I would like to be able to interpret this sign language, how she's going to interpret this rubber top in the sign language, how you get the southern drawl there. But then, I'm the last of seven children. I had three brothers, three sisters, and they were alcoholics. My father and my grandfather were both alcoholics, as I can look back and most people in Alcoholics Anonymous say that they would never ever call anybody alcoholic. Well, I will. I will. If I've seen you drunk and you act the way I did, I will certainly risk the anger to call you an alcoholic. My dad and his father spent something like 75 years in the courthouse in Benton, Arkansas, in Saline County. They were justice, judges, and that sort of thing, county politics, and I grew up in that atmosphere. My mother was a little Irish lady, her name was O'Neill, and 5 feet tall, and she could have started our line. My father could take a drink clear across county, and my mother was an invalid. She suffered from Parkinson's disease, and the minute my dad the liquor touched my dad's lips, my mother came to. She knew all about it. And it was something that I was clear that I'd never do. Mother was sick all of my life. And we kids grew up, one of us having the duty, so to speak, to be with mother. And I brought into Alcoholics Anonymous an awful lot of guilt and hate for myself over that, because on my duty days when I was a kid, then instead of being able to go out and play football or whatever we were doing, I would oftentimes have to go home and just stay with mother. And I remember as a kid, I wish she'd die. You know, she was the most loving person in the world, but then this is the insanity of the magicness that I had in my life. Dad always left the house by going in and kissing mother and telling her, I'm going to the office, Dad, and her plane shot was always, as far as I can remember, "You don't drink today." And his response was, I won't bow. And with that, he was drawn off to the courthouse. And he didn't drink every day, but on the days that he did, my mother had that intuitive feeling. And she would say to my sister, and I, you should go to the courthouse and walk home with Dad. And if Dad had already found the man that had offered him a drink, and he had taken the drink that day, then we would walk home with him. And he would be staggered. He was a rubber leg drunk, and he was a politician, and he talked to everybody. And from the time that I was knee high, I would look at him and wonder. I hated him. I hated him because he had told Mother that morning that he wouldn't drink. So then I don't know what the genetic factor is, but then this has happened in the lives of so many of these people in our cult phenomenon. The embarrassment that I brought with this, I certainly would never drink. But then when I entered junior high school, I was probably almost the size of a man in a small town. I started playing football and running track and boxing and that sort of thing. And I was playing with the big boys, and they started drinking, and they offered this stuff to me, and I liked it. I found out that I know why you like it, too. It's on page XXVI of our book. It's scientific. It says that most of us drink because we like the feeling, the way it made us feel. Now, that's scientific. If anybody in the medical profession can use that line, if you want. If you're a counselor, you can tell people why they drink. When I found that that stuff made me feel like that, and it was around, it came first in my life. It was the most important thing that I did. The year that I was my senior year of high school, I was captain of the football team, and I had been well treated going through my sophomore and junior year. And I was running with the pack, and we would, in Arkansas, we bought our own school books. But if you played football, they gave them to you. And if you were good enough, you didn't have to use them. As soon as they issued the school books, we would immediately sell them. And it wasn't difficult to know that they didn't give you that many books. So when the market was right at the beginning of school, we would steal them. And this was fine while other people were the leaders, because they were smart enough to steal the books, we would get in the car and go to Little Rock to our top bookstore, and we would sell them. The year that I was the leader of the pack, I was looking for the easier, softer way. So then we stole the books, but instead of going to Little Rock to sell them, we started selling them at the next row. This is kind of close quarters when you get caught. They went to study hall, and the superintendent wanted to know who had been stealing these books, and I want you to know I was helping them look. Finally, there was a little voice from the back of the room, and the fellow said, my name is written on page whatever in my literature book, and son of a gun. He turned over to that page, and everybody turned to that page, and Phil O'Neill kind of ducked in a chair, and I knew the jig was up. So I got up and went down to the left study hall and walked down to the superintendent's office, and the football coach followed me, and I was suspended from school. That was the first football game, and I was not allowed to suit up. The football coach had protected me again. He wrapped my knee as if I'd had an accident or a trip knee, and I didn't see that night. The next day they had a meeting school board, and I, of course, approached that school board, and I told them the same thing that you would tell them, that I had never stolen anything before, and that I had certainly learned my lesson, and I would never steal anything again. And I was crying with it, and they believed me. And I went out. I was all right. They let me back to school. I must add, the first job that I had was delivering milk And that was hopping on and off the milk wagon and went up and dropped a quart of milk, and the customers put their money in the bottle, and on the way back to the truck, two or three times a day, I would palm that money and hand the bottle to Mr. Hope, and he would hold out his hand for the money, and I would say, "When was that?" So you see, I was a liar and a thief at my first job. Now, when I finished in high school, I went on and joined the Navy, and I can get in and out of this in a hurry. I did 19 years in the Navy, and I became a storekeeper, and then a pay clerk and a supply officer. And I'll let you know that when I retired from the Navy, he walked into my house and had a pension, everything in it stood up. So you see, I came here with some defects of character. And drinking a little drinky pee is not my worst offense. So that this is something that I come to find out that these were my root problems. We believe that the root cause of our alcoholism is selfishness and self-centeredness. And I was always looking for where my money was coming from. And believe me, I would split anything with anybody as long as I got 90% and gave me 10. So it was just upright. I don't remember going back to the train station from my first Liberty. I'd been quarantined for about 6 weeks, and I was taken back to the ship. And after I get out about 19 years, I have a gentleman sitting on the front row with me that I have known for 36 or 7 years. We've been very, very close during that naval career, and he would attest to the fact that I never left any ship or station to which I was attached without going ashore to do some drinking. Now, I don't want to lead you to the pain that I stayed drunk every time I went ashore. I didn't. But then drinking was the most important occupation that I had. It was the most important thing that I did. During my naval career, I had several responsible jobs. I was manager of the Chiefs Club in Honolulu, and that was the biggest Chiefs Club that the Navy had. It was the most enviable job around. We had something like 200 slot machines and four balls and a bingo game, and I had the keys to them all. So that I remember a captain's conference that we had at the naval station each Thursday. The heads of each department would meet the captain's office, and Captain Wiggins was always the man that said, "Never complain about somebody else's department unless you have the solution to that complaint." That anybody can complain about somebody else, but if you have a complaint, be sure that you write out your own solution. This eliminates an awful lot of complaints. But then I had been badgered about charging too much money for booze in the liquor store, and we had a good liquor salesman that Bert told me, said, "Frank, you'd be surprised how cheaply you can buy booze for retail in the liquor store if you bought a carload lot." So then I went to the next captain's conference, and I told the captain about this, and Captain Wilson said, "But my God, where would you store it?" And I said, "I have just the place." You see, immediately after Pearl Harbor, they built bomb shelters all over Pearl Harbor. But then they never bombed the place anymore, and the bomb shelters were never used. I had one that would reach from here to the corner behind the Chiefs Club. And you know, when I got that carload of booze in, it was neatly stored away in that bomb shelter behind, close to the village, right behind the Black Arena this time last year. They had a bomb shelter that reached here to the corner. I had that sucker chucked full of cases of booze, and I had the only damn key on the island. So you talk about having a good, comfortable feeling about knowing where your next drink is coming from. I got out of there by the skin of my teeth, and better get on getting tired out of it, maybe. When I did retire from the Navy, it was as a result of a heart condition that I believe was accelerated by an awful lot of fast drinking. And I was retired and didn't know a thing in the world what to do. The only job that I had up until that time, I was a member of the bartender union, and I was tending bar at Lakewood Country Club. We had a hostess there that had worked for a Felicity Country Club her husband had down in Riverside County, and they told me, said, "Frank, I think that you'd make a real good real estate salesman, and I have a friend that owns this country club, and I believe that you'd be good selling membership." To make a long story short, I went to work for this Coyote Valley Country Club. Now, I never got over to the Brentwood area to sell Coyote Valley Country Club. But if you people that have come down from Riverside County around Baltimore, Anaheim, or Long Beach, if I told you, your parents, any of that membership in Coyote Valley Country Club, I'm not here to make amends. But then this was a job that afforded me all day to drink, and I went out and sold his membership from 7 until 9:30, and that's a good life. But then I, like every good alcoholic, we can't stay in comfort. We're nervous and irritable and discontent. So I went in one day and I told Virginia that I'm unhappy with this job, and that what I really want to do is to own a little cocktail lounge. If I just had a little cocktail lounge, everything would be all right. I thought that was unique until I got here and I found out every damn one of you wanted your own cocktail lounge. We hocked the family jewels and I bought a cocktail lounge, the only one that I could afford, and some of you are familiar with it. I was able to buy the polka dot, the famous polka dot that was on the corner of 108th and South Broadway in Los Angeles. Now, for you people that are unacquainted with your geography, that was Watts before Watts became Watts. And I can get in and out of there in a hurry. I stayed there 3 years, and it's unimportant for a group like this whether you make any money. If you're able to drink wholesale for 3 years, that ain't bad. This is about what I did, and I can let you know of the insanity of my drinking. We always meet these people in our Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. They're special people. They're people that have a favorite bar. They know the bartender or the owner or the waitress anyway, or the waiter, and as soon as closing time goes, the shutters go in and the doors lock. And the people in the know come out from the head and the office and under the tables, and they line up at the bar after closing time like turtles on a log. And that's where most of us started taking inventory of the people that had left there. So this night, on Friday night, we had taken everybody's inventory, and everybody had left, and there were probably 12 or 14 that were still in the bar, and we drank and related the history of the night and all of this, and then there was an after-hour nightclub that was just opening at 102nd and Main, and Bob had invited us over, so this was where we decided to go. You certainly couldn't go home at 4 or 4:30, could you? So that the last thing I did was reach on the shelf and tuck a bottle of scotch in my left arm and throw my jacket over my right shoulder. They locked the bar, and I was walking down 108th Street, which is real popular in Southern California now, but in 1963, it wasn't happening too often, but a car drove by and fired 3 times. Bang, bang, bang. And the next thing I know, I'm hit. And I'm falling, but you'll be happy to know I just didn't fall like that. I had that bottle of scotch, and I just slithered down. I found myself laying on the sidewalk, and I thought, God, you don't want to be caught dead with a bottle of booze. And I rolled that bottle across. I can see that green bottle rolling now. And I told the fellow to take care of it, and he did. The ambulance rushed me to Morningside Emergency Hospital, and they x-rayed me, and the plug had passed through my left arm, and they were in at my side, and was resting very neatly right in the muscle at my spine. And the doctor told me how fortunate I was, that I wasn't paralyzed or hadn't been killed, and that he was going to transfer me. I told him that I was a retired naval officer, and that I would go down on the Haven. Now, this, I guess 10 or 15 years ago, 10 years ago anyway, I finally gained humility when I told an audience of this size that when I you find that you're a retired naval officer, it sounds like you're somebody. But then when I tell them that I'm a retired ensign in the Navy, that lets it all go, because there's nothing lower than unity. Anyway, he told me he didn't want to let me go, and I told him, you can't keep me. So then the entourage that had followed the ambulance out to Morningside Emergency Hospital, they were there when I walked out of the hospital and loaded in the car, and two or three cars left. You know where we went. We went to the club town hill. They had my arm neatly wrapped, but where the slug had entered my side, they just had a band-aid stuck over that sucker. Not a lot of attention. I went in there and they said, here comes Mr. Cleary, he's the dude that was hit. So then I had 50 glasses of vodka, and then finally got down on the Haven. There were two police officers waiting alongside for my wife. You see, there were two vice officers that were people in the know when we were closing the bar. So the Los Angeles police wanted to know who was shooting at their police officers. My wife was the pilot of the gang around how they x-rayed me tomorrow, and I told her, Virginia, you go home. When you come back at 4 o'clock, you bring me a bottle of vodka. And she came at 4 o'clock, and she didn't have the bottle of vodka. I threatened her with her life, and run her off the ship, and I told her, you come back tonight, you stop by and see Spence, the chief club, and he will give you a bottle, you bring it aboard. She came and she didn't have the bottle. She left and I left. I found my clothes and I got the hell off that ship. I didn't go home. I went back up to the polka dot. Now then, I don't have a medical degree and I'm not in the field of medicine. But then if you ever get shot, you can kill you the same way as I did mine. I went back up to the polka dot and I drank vodka, glass after glass. I wrote my left hand up on the bar head, and that's the only medical treatment I've had. The slug is still in my body. I don't know whether you could get that as a cure-all or not, but then it's been a long time. But then the only thing that I would say about that, and it certainly has nothing to do with you being an Alcoholics Anonymous, except to let you know that ain't social drinking. When I left the bar business, and I did, Virginia saw what was happening. She told me across the breakfast table one morning, can't sell the bar. And I assured her that I couldn't sell the bar. Of course, I didn't want to sell the thing that was the greatest call that a person ever had. And I was getting home after staying at the motel 3 or 4 days a week, and then finally a week or 10 days at a time. And my children were literally scared to death when I did come in, and she was living in all this anxiety. And finally she asked me one other day, sell the bar. And I told you I can't sell the bar. And Virginia looked across the desk of the table and said, then Frank, just give it away. Because you see, she knew what was happening, and she could see it and I didn't. I finally sold the bar. I got out of the bar and I went to selling real estate, and instead of selling houses and lots, I started selling beer bars and cocktail lounges and business opportunities, and I went to work early and I stayed late. I worked awfully hard at this, and it was good, but then when your office is just 4 or 5 miles across town, it's terribly difficult when it takes you 4 or 5 days to get home. And this is the way I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous on the 17th of August. I had been gone from home on a safari for 2 or 3 days, and I don't know how long. When I went into the house, as I pulled in the driveway, I remembered it was my wedding anniversary. And we celebrated everything at our house, birthdays and anniversaries and so forth. But on this day, I was caught. I didn't have a card, a box of candy, about 4 flowers, or nothing. I went into the house and Virginia met me with her usual greeting, and she had that forlorn look on her face, and I told her I was sick. I thought that she would recognize that my heart had been palpitating, Now, I can get agreement in a group like this, because if you've been gone from home for 4 or 5 days, and you come in, you're sick. And we understand that. But then, instead of her rushing me up to the major hospital, she said, "Frank, would you go to Alcoholics Anonymous? I think that I told you by this time that I really thought I was probably the smartest man in Southern California anyway, but I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, because it was my 19th wedding anniversary and I had no other excuse, I said, "Yes, let's call and make an appointment." So then when I called, I asked they asked if I knew where Morgan Hall was, and I showed them that I did. And then she asked me a silly question. She said, "Do you have transportation?" And I showed her that I had a new Continental. And when Virginia drove us down there and I got out of that car and looked at that old tall building, I looked at that thing and I thought, "God, if you're going to join something, we can have a little more class than this." And I thought even more of it when I got in the elevator and went up on the fourth floor, and this Helen says, "May I help you?" And I thought to myself, "Honey, with a voice like that, she says, do nothing for me." Except that she knew all about me. She looked at me and she saw right through me the arrogance and the conceit and the selfishness and the self-centeredness, and she looked at Virginia and smiled and gave me a card with those 20 questions. Now, if you newcomers haven't taken that yet, listen to this advice and it'll save you some embarrassment. Read the directions before you complete it. Because I didn't read these directions, I hurriedly sat on over the table and checked those things off and walked back over and I handed it to Helen, and she just glanced at and said, "Well, you're sure the right place?" And I wonder how in the hell do you know? Because you think she hadn't read with anything, but I hadn't read the directions. If you answer one out of those 20 questions, you've got a problem. And if you answer 2 out of the 20, you've got a lot of problems. And if you answer 3 or more yeses, you're a dead stinking fish. And she degraded my card clear across the parking lot because I'd lied to be here and had 11 or 12 yeses on that. So when I passed with that great success, I wanted to tell her, "You give me that card back. I believe I can score better next time. I'm going to just lie more." And she told me, "Well, you'll be happy to know that you're an alcoholic tonight, and we just don't drink a beer at a time." The curtain came down because I knew I couldn't go a day at a time. You remember the ship deal? I knew I couldn't go a day at a time without drinking. So what else was there? There's always an estimate. There's always somebody in the age that could give us the word or the fuck up. And this guy was named Mel, and he was there to pick up his announcements for the John Kerr Memorial Group on Saturday night, and he said, "Frank, my sponsor said we don't have to stop drinking a day at a time." Man, my antenna went straight up. I wanted to hear what he had to say, but that woman was talking about didn't make sense. And he said, "My sponsor said, you just don't take a drink right now. That hit my pigmy brain just right." And I went over and I took Virginia and I said, "Let's get the hell out of here. I know how this works." You see, we become fast learners. We went home and Virginia, while I was taking that test, Virginia bought one of everything. That morning would have bought the Montgomery Ward catalog. Driving home, I found through these books that Virginia bought, and I kind of thought to myself, "Well, this is a little different anniversary gift. I sure hope she enjoys reading these things." When I got home, Mary said, "Don't drink right now." And I didn't. I had a cupboard full of booze and I didn't drink. And that afternoon, Saturday afternoon, I was walking through the living room. I looked out my front window and up the sidewalk, walked a fellow. His name was Bud, and he was well dressed. He was followed by a guy that looked just like I felt. I later found out he was the pigeon called on just before he got me. I can almost hear Helen tell Bud, "Put on your Bill Wilson t-shirt and go out on Studebaker Road, take a butterfly net, maybe you can catch this nut." He was a young real estate broker, and he ran in my front door and said, "My name is Bud. I'm an alcoholic anonymous. Can I come in?" And with that, he was sitting in my living room. And he was going to say the hard sell crap that every newcomer is sick of. That you hear somebody tell how wonderful and glorious things are going to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me that that by the abandoned Christian roundups and potlucks and dances and conventions, and we drink coffee and eat donuts, and I thought you'd say bastard. I'm sick of a billy goat, and you want me to eat donuts. You asked me if I would go to a meeting with him, and I said yes. I knew if he got him out of the house, I just wouldn't let him back in. But that night he's come by and picked me up and took me to Signal Hill. And you people don't know, but see, there's nothing on Signal Hill now 25 years later. But then there was absolutely nothing then. The meeting met in the basement of the old city hall. And they had a sign hanging out there with red letters, and it was too big. But then they had a light shining on it. And when I went in there, I thought, well, my God, why don't they take the sign in, or at least turn the light off, somebody could see you walk in here. And I thought I was just unfair, but if you were a threat with me, you looked over your shoulder when you came to your first AA meeting, too. You don't want your high school counselor to see you walking in here, do you? So I went in there, and everybody was standing around with their AA grin. Everybody except the newcomers. And they offered me a cup of coffee, and before I could say no, they handed me a cup with a handle on it. And I was as nervous as a good girl in a bad place. I slipped that coffee dry. That coffee all over the desk. I wanted to get the hell out of there right then. But they seated me on the second row, where Larry is right now, between my wife and the donut eater. And they did all this reading. After the reading, I got up and I went to the back of the room, and I told the coffee maker that where I was going. You know, I told her gave her my physical history. I told her that I was retired from the Navy and that I had a heart condition and I suffered from claustrophobia. Have you ever seen a drunk with claustrophobia? Never will. Come on in, there's plenty of room. I told him that I had a nervous stomach, and I went outside and puked. And I came back in and, had a sink at the back of the room, and I washed my face and bald head. And I threw that cold water up there, and I dried my head with paper towels, and went stuck up here. And I tell you that coffee maker, you go get my wife and a donut eater and get the hell out of this place. And that was my first meeting. So you see, I volunteered. I was one of the volunteers. I went home and I didn't drink anything that night. And I didn't drink anything for the next 35 days. And after 35 days, that's long enough for any non-alcoholic to go without a drink, isn't it? I left the Navy meeting and I went up and I drank at the Eldorado, and I intended to drink that night and Saturday and Sunday. I'd quit drinking again. You see, I'd known how to quit. I'd quit once before. Sunday rolled around and I couldn't quit. I was still there and I wanted to quit so badly. I knew I had to go back to a meeting that night, and I took a guy with me. Both I said, Ray Mays, and we used to go to the racetrack and drink an awful lot with him. He was manager of the Ralph Market. And Sid and I had been drinking, I don't know how long, and he was drunk and I was, and I knew if I had to go to a meeting, Sid needed it, he was bad. So I took to a meeting though he didn't want to go. I was trying to give this thing away before I had it. I took Sid in, we walked into East Bend, it was a big meeting, and I walked into the back of the meeting, everybody turned to look at me drunk, and we were talking, I don't know, raising hell, going to drive out or something, Sid started coughing. I wanted him to fall dead because everybody in the meeting was looking at us, and we newcomers don't like for people to look at us. We like to kind of blend in with the walls. Sid finally stopped coughing. The meeting was over, and we started walking out. Sid says, "Honey, said I'm not going anymore to more meetings with you." And I said, "Man, you can bet your sweet ass on that, and you cause a spectacle of yourself." We went out, and that was the only time that my drinking ever bothered me. From then until the following 28th of March, I went to a meeting every day. My knuckles were as wide as could be, and I gritted my teeth, and I did everything well. I would have given anything to have been able to stop drinking. I know today I would have given a hand, or a foot even, to have been able to stop drinking, but I couldn't. During this period of time, my daughter was 13 years of age, about the end of my drinking. Kathy was 13 years of age, and this child had had so much surgery, you can't believe. And she was just the apple of my eye. I loved her more than anything in the world. And Kathy asked me this one day, "Dad, don't drink today." And I promised her that I wouldn't. And then Kathy said, Would you go to the Father God of Benefit, and I promised her that I would not drink that day. And on my way to Pastor God, she asked me if I'd say it on the Bible, and I did. And she smiled at me on the way out, and on my way to the office, I had a bottle of vodka in the car, and I was parked behind the security master bank, and I had to take a drink. And I drank that bottle of vodka like I had to take my next breath. From then until today, I would have given anything if I could have stopped, but then that was the disease of alcoholism. The time that I have spent in Alcoholics Anonymous Sanctuary, I thought I had 10 more minutes to tell the speaker how long he has. The time that I spent in Alcoholics Anonymous from then until the 28th of March, that was the day before Easter of 1964, and I wanted to stop drinking more than anything in the world, and I couldn't. The 28th of March, I had come in off of another round away from home, and I saw the Jane. She was in the car and had my children in the car heading to Glendale, and I told her that you don't have to leave because I'm not going to drink this weekend. And she smiled at me and told me, says, you know you're not drinking because you want to. I hope that you'll be able to come and have dinner with us tomorrow, and that she drove away. I had listened to Chuck talk so many times that between every two drunks, he's got his 30 years now. He walked and prayed and died. And that's what I did. I went into the house and I did that. I walked and prayed and walking through the house, I found myself at the foot of my bed. And I said a prayer along this line, God, you know I've been going to those meetings. If you will help me to get sober, I will do whatever I can for Alcoholics Anonymous. And you see, from that day until today, I haven't had to take a drink. That was the 28th of March, 1964, and until today, things have been going well. Because you have taught me how to live. You have taught me how to care and how to share. You have loved me when I couldn't love myself. You have been kind to me when I didn't know what kindness was. Tonight, when the newcomer, as in any other, go home and go to bed, things happen in our lives that we don't like, and it still happens whether we're drunk or sober. Things go on in our lives that are not to our liking. There's divorces and deaths and sicknesses and things that are just don't make joyous living. But then you have taught me that when I ask for help, that I am willing for good things to happen. So in the night when you go home and you go to bed, the lights are out and there's no one around except you. This is when we can really know who we are. Tonight you bury your head and your pillow just a little deeper. And you just say, help. God knows who God is. And it isn't important that you know who he is. He does not need any directions from the book. So when we say help, that is knocking and the door will open and we seek a new time. That red light has been on for 2 minutes, and I'm sorry about that. I am delighted to be here. I love all of you people. And then more than anything else, I want to meet some newcomers. I want to tell you.
Because of my experience has been in Alcoholics Anonymous, any time that I have ever received a phone call from anyone, I have needed that phone call to bring me down to earth far more than anybody that I have ever helped. So, and I'm delighted to be here, and I want to say God bless you all. Thank you.